Welcome to the Deep Dive. We tackle complex source materials and, well, basically give you the shortcut. Today, we're diving into something pretty radical, something that hits close to home for many and speaks to maybe collective evolution. The core question is this: what if what we call attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, isn't actually a flaw? What if it's a highly specialized, optimized way the brain can be configured?
It's a total paradigm shift, really. We're exploring what some sources are calling the neurodivergent renaissance. The goal is moving completely past seeing it as just a deficit. So our mission today is to unpack two really, really different blueprints for a world potentially designed for these minds. On one hand, we've got a plan based on rigorous cognitive architecture, very scientific. And then quite differently, there's this other view framed as a kind of vast metaphysical or cosmic blueprint.
Yeah, it's fascinating because you have to hold these like totally different perspectives side by side. But what's really striking is that both paths, however different, they seem to land on a similar idea that ADHD traits aren't mistakes, but maybe evolutionary advantages, good for exploration, innovation, spotting patterns, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And both argue that the real task isn't to fix the individual mind. It's about redesigning our systems, you know, schools, workplaces, maybe even culture itself. They call the end goal symbiotic cognitive ecosystem.
A symbiotic cognitive ecosystem. Okay, that sounds big. So it really is about the architecture, like you said. Where do we start? We need to understand the operating system first.
Precisely. Before you build the house, you need the blueprint of what goes inside.
Okay, so let's get into this shift. It's not just asking for small changes, is it? This movement seems to be pushing for a complete rethink. Seeing these traits as actual strengths, moving away from demanding everyone fit into neat little boxes, and instead focusing on what unique things people can contribute, like valuing brilliance over just consistency.
Right. And that's where the cognitive architect model comes in. It tries to map out exactly how this mind works differently. They talk about the ADHD mind as its own operating system. One specifically optimized for exploration, not for, say, predictable output. It's seen as an adaptive system, built to handle, maybe even thrive, on the edge of chaos, which, let's face it, is where a lot of innovation happens. And a key technical idea here is that for this internal OS to work well in our current world, we need to build something around it. An external coprocessor.
An external coprocessor. I like that. So the idea is you kind of outsource the boring stuff, like managing schedules or filtering noise. You let tech or the environment handle that, freeing up the mind for the big picture stuff.
Exactly. It offloads the cognitive load of managing incompatible environments. But to build that support system, you need the specs of the internal hardware. And the sources get really detailed here. They lay out a specific four-layered architecture. This structure, they argue, demands system redesign. So let's start at the bottom layer. Perception, how the information comes in.
Okay, layer one, perception. What's the deal there?
They describe it using two key terms, high bandwidth and low filter. Imagine your internet connection trying to download everything all at once, constantly. The attentional aperture, the focus window is really wide. And sensory gating, you know, the brain's normal ability to tune out the background hum of the lights or the tag scratching your neck that's turned down.
So less filtering means more data gets in. What does that actually feel like?
Well, it leads to this incredibly rich, high-fidelity stream of information about everything around you.
Yeah.
Novelty, anything new or different, potential connections, even potential dangers, they get prioritized automatically. It's not that the mind is failing to filter in the conventional sense. It's more like it's running a deep environmental scan constantly. It's very much a bottom-up system. Whatever is loudest, most interesting, or most salient grabs the attention. It ensures you're really aware. But yeah, it's a lot of input.
Okay, so feeling overwhelmed by sensations isn't necessarily a weakness. It could be the system doing its job too well, in a sense, gathering maximum data. Like that phrase one source used, reality streaming in HD plus perception.
Exactly. It's potentially a higher fidelity perception system, but all that raw data has to go somewhere, right? It can't just sit there.
So what happens next? Layers two and three.
That fire hose of data feeds directly into the next two layers, which work together, the integration and abstraction layers. This is where the magic, or maybe the chaos, happens, the creative engine. Because the input wasn't heavily filtered in the usual way, the information gets processed associatively. Yeah. Think of it like a giant mind map where everything potentially connects to everything else. This is the root of what they call hyperconnectivity, that knack for seeing connections between things that seem totally unrelated to other people.
Ah, so that's the out-of-the-box thinking connection, making leaps others don't see. And the abstraction layer, what does that do? Does it try to make sense of all these connections?
Yes. but maybe not in the way you'd expect. Instead of settling on one single stable explanation or model, this layer tends to generate multiple possibilities simultaneously. It's like it's running several different simulations or prototypes of reality in parallel. Fluid models. This fuels amazing pattern recognition, and it makes this kind of mind naturally geared towards innovation. It's constantly generating alternatives, even if it struggles sometimes to pick just one and stick to it.
Wow, okay. A parallel processing unit, constantly exploring options. But that sounds like it could be hard to manage. Which brings us to the top layer, right? Metacognition and executive function. This is where the traditional deficit label usually lands, focusing on problems with control or focus.
And this is where the cognitive architects really flip the script. They argue this layer isn't broken or deficient. It just doesn't operate like a standard top-down controller that demands consistent effort on command. Instead, they describe it as using a really sophisticated variable gain control system. Think of gain like turning up the volume or power. This system is optimized for exploration and reacting quickly in dynamic situations.
Variable gain.
Yeah.
What does that mean practically? How does it work day to day?
It means the system's engagement level, the cognitive resources it throws at a task, is driven primarily by intrinsic interest, novelty, urgency, or high stakes. If something genuinely fascinates the person, or if there's a real challenge or a looming deadline boom, the gain gets cranked to maximum. That's when you see hyperfocus, that state where someone can do incredible, complex work super fast, totally absorbed. But if a task is seen as boring, arbitrary, pointless, or low reward, the system efficiently turns the gain down. Minimal resources allocated.
So it's not a lack of focus, it's a different strategy for allocating focus. It's conserving energy for what the system deems truly important, based on interest or urgency.
Precisely. It's an internal calculation of potential payoff, emotional, intellectual, maybe even survival-based. If the payoff seems low, the executive function basically says, nope, let's pay attention to that interesting new thing the perception layer just picked up. Or let's save energy. And this understanding leads directly to the core design insight from these sources. We have to stop trying to force this unique mental hardware to run standard linear software. The smart move is to build that external coprocessor, the environmental supports, the tools, the structures that manage the low-interest stuff. Things like automated reminders, visual timers, body doubling, clear organizational systems, they act as the scaffold, allowing the mind's strengths in exploration and hyperfocus to shine.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. If the mind is built for exploration, for parallel processing, for this variable gain, then the problem isn't the mind itself. It's the environment it's stuck in. Which brings us to the systems we actually live and work in. Let's talk about what the sources call the industrial OS. You know, the standard setup, linear classrooms, rows of desks, standardized tests, the 9-to-5 grind. Why are these so fundamentally mismatched?
Well, think about when those systems were really perfected. During the Industrial Revolution, right? They were designed for compliance, for predictability, for producing workers who could sustain attention on repetitive tasks for long hours, whether they liked it or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's a batch processing model. It demands you suppress novelty, ignore distractions, follow rigid sequences. That's the exact opposite of how the ADHD cognitive architecture operates.
Mm-hmm.
So when you force this highly exploratory, associative, interest-driven mind into that rigid sequential box, you get friction. You get stress, underperformance, frustration. It's like the environment is actively starving the brain of what it needs to function well.
Like trying to run, I don't know, a high-end gaming PC on software from the 90s. The hardware is capable, but the software is just wrong. So if that's the problem, what's the proposed solution, architecturally speaking? Let's start with education. How do we redesign the classroom from assembly line to exploration sandbox, as the sources put it?
Right, the exploration sandbox. First, you tackle the physical environment to support that high bandwidth perception layer.
Yeah.
Structural changes. This means accepting, even encouraging, movement and sensory engagement, not punishing it. We're talking about things like standing desks as standard, maybe options for weighted lap pads or chairs you can subtly bounce on, definitely spaces designed for fidgeting. And crucially, regular physical activity breaks aren't just rewards, they're built into the schedule, seen as necessary for cognitive function, not a distraction from it.
Okay, makes sense. Accommodate the need for movement and different sensory inputs. What about the learning itself? To engage those integration and abstraction layers, the hyperconnectivity.
That requires a total curriculum overhaul.
Yeah.
You have to break down the silos between subjects. Learning needs to be primarily project-based and interdisciplinary. The sources suggest things like tackling grand challenges. So, instead of separate classes for physics, biology, ethics, design, a whole semester might be spent on a complex problem, like, say, design a sustainable food system for a new Mars colony. That forces students to pull together knowledge from everywhere: science, engineering, sociology, economics. It directly leverages that strength in seeing connections. And learning pathways become much more interest-based, letting students dive deep, really hyper-focus on aspects that genuinely grab them within that larger project.
That sounds way more engaging, but how do you measure success in a system like that? It definitely requires a metric shift, right? You can't just grade based on multiple choice tests or how neat their notes are.
Absolutely not. The whole evaluation model has to change. You shift to assessing the depth of their understanding, the creativity of their solutions, the complexity of the connections they made. Mastery can be shown in lots of ways. Maybe they build a working prototype. Maybe they code a simulation. Maybe they give a brilliant oral presentation. Maybe they write a detailed research paper. This allows that variable game system to lock on to things they care about, leading to real learning, not just measuring compliance or short-term memorization of boring facts.
This sounds fantastic, honestly, like the kind of school I wish I'd gone to. But it also sounds expensive and hard to implement everywhere. How do we know it actually works better? The sources don't just leave it at theory, do they? They actually propose a way to test this rigorously, the rigorous scientific model, and a really detailed plan.
Yes, and this focus on evidence is critical if these ideas are going to gain traction beyond advocacy. They lay out a specific intervention to be tested. It's a hybrid approach. It combines AI-driven, personalized, pacing think learning software that adapts to the student's rhythm and interests, kind of like a supercharged Khan Academy, with mandatory focus anchors, maybe simple organizational tools or apps to provide structure, and, interestingly, optional low-cost neurofeedback. They even suggest specific tech, like those Muse headbands, you know, for real-time brainwave training to help with attention regulation.
Okay, so adaptive tech plus structure plus optional brain training. And how would they test if that combo actually improves things? They mention a specific study design.
Yeah, they go into serious detail. They call for a large-scale randomized controlled trial, RCT. That's the gold standard in research. They specify needing about 500 participants. That's a lot. But it's needed because they want to stratify the sample. That means carefully grouping participants based on things like their scores on the Vanderbilt rating scales. Those are common tools used to diagnose ADHD and identify subtypes, and also based on how severe the symptoms are. They calculate this sample size is needed to achieve 80% statistical power, which is a standard benchmark for reliable findings.
They also throw in a technical term, ICC of 0.1 via optimal design. What's that about? Sounds important for making the results trustworthy.
It is. The ICC, or intra-class correlation coefficient, deals with a common problem in education research. Students are grouped in classrooms and schools. Kids in the same class share a teacher, maybe similar environments, so the results aren't truly independent. The ICC estimates how much of the variation in outcomes is due to being in the same group. An ICC of never 0.1 means about 10% of the difference between students is just down to which group they're in. To get statistically meaningful results, despite that clustering effect, you need a large, well-designed study like the one they propose. It shows they're serious about real-world validity.
Okay, so they've thought through the statistics. It's proper science. What are they actually hoping to prove? What are the specific hypothesis targets?
They set some tough goals. First, the main intervention, the adaptive learning instructor, needs to achieve at least a 25% course completion rate for the students involved. That would be a big improvement over typical dropout rates in some settings. And critically, they want to see less than a 10% fade or decline in executive function scores over 6 months. They specify using the BRIEF2 to measure this.
The BRIEF2, what does that measure?
The Behavior Rating Inventory of Executive Function, second edition. It's a widely used questionnaire, usually filled out by parents or teachers. It looks at observable behaviors related to executive functions, things like planning, organization, working memory, inhibiting impulses, emotional control. Maintaining those brief scores would suggest the intervention is genuinely improving underlying skills, not just forcing temporary compliance. Their second hypothesis is about the neurofeedback. They predict that adding the optional brain training should boost those executive function gains by an extra 10% compared to the group without it. That would justify the cost and effort of the tech.
And they even have a backup plan if the tech proves too expensive, right? The cost and feasibility check.
Exactly. They're being pragmatic.
No.
You set a threshold. If the average cost per student for the neurofeedback headsets works out to be more than $100, acknowledging current tech is often pricier than the study pivots, they'd switch that component out for a gamified app-based intervention instead, something cheaper and easier to scale. Even then, they have a clear target. The app version should still aim for a 15% improvement in retention or engagement. They benchmark this against existing research, showing about 12% gains from similar digital tools. It's an agile plan, ready to adapt based on data and cost.
Okay, that's a compelling vision for education. Now, let's apply the same thinking to the workplace. Moving from factory floor to incubator network, the typical 9-to-5 office job, sitting at a desk doing assigned tasks. That seems like the ultimate challenge for the ADHD cognitive style.
It really is the antithesis of the variable gain system, isn't it? It demands sustained, moderate focus on tasks that might hold zero intrinsic interest. So the redesigned workplace needs to embrace agile and fluidity. Work isn't structured around steady clock-watching days. It's built around short, intense bursts, sprints, like in software development, maybe 2 to 4 weeks long. These sprints are focused on specific missions or projects. This aligns perfectly with the brain's natural rhythm. Hyper-focus on an engaging challenge, followed by essential downtime for recovery, reflection, and yes, exploration. You chunk the work to keep the interest engine firing.
And the physical space needs to change too, right? To match the environmental design needed for that high bandwidth perception.
Absolutely. Monotony is the enemy. You need variety and choice. The ideal office becomes a network of cognitive niches. Think modular spaces you can easily adapt. You need quiet pods for deep focused work when hyper-focus kicks in. You need lively, open areas designed to encourage collaboration and those creative collisions. You need comfortable restorative zones, maybe with natural light, plants, things that soothe the senses. The architecture itself needs to be sensory aware, managing noise levels, lighting options, allowing for movement.
The sources use a great analogy for the culture shift needed here, the chef's metaphor. The workplace isn't an assembly line, it's a bustling kitchen.
Yeah, I love that one. The chef argues that forcing the 9-to-5 structure onto a team of divergent thinkers is like, quote, trying to bake a cake in a microwave. It might get done technically, but you lose all the nuance, the potential, the proper rise. A busy kitchen, on the other hand, is chaotic, sure. It's loud, it's fast-paced, maybe a bit messy. But it's filled with focused energy, specialized skills working together, intense bursts of creativity under pressure. It values speed and adaptation.
And a key part of it, kitchen culture, is how you handle mistakes, isn't it? No room for perfectionism.
Definitely not. The chef says mistakes are just burnt pans. You acknowledge them, you learn how to clean them up or avoid them next time, but they aren't catastrophes. They even suggest having failure feasts, literally celebrating the lessons learned from things that went wrong. This builds psychological safety. It allows people, especially those with highly creative, maybe risk-prone minds, to experiment, to prototype rapidly, knowing that failure is part of the process. The value is in the learning, the adaptation, the practice gained in the heat of the kitchen, not just in churning out flawless widgets every time.
Okay. We've just built this incredibly in-detailed, science-backed case for redesigning education and work based on cognitive architecture and rigorous testing. Now, we need to take a deep breath, because the other major perspective in our source material takes us somewhere completely different. We're shifting from, you know, RCTs and neurofeedback to nebulae and, well, cosmic volunteers.
Yeah.
Let's unpack the metaphysical hypothesis.
Right. It's a dramatic shift in framing, but the sources present it with equal conviction. This non-traditional view proposes that the unique brain wiring we've been describing, the high bandwidth, the hyperconnectivity, the variable gain, isn't just a random neurological variation. It's interpreted as evidence of something called volunteer consciousness. The idea is that these are souls, maybe galactic beings or star seeds, who have intentionally chosen to incarnate on Earth at this time, their purpose, to operate within and ultimately help transform our current linear, often challenging, three-dimensional reality. Some sources affectionately call it Earth School.
Wow. Okay. So the difficulties experienced, the struggles with linear systems, the feeling out of sync that's seen not as a disorder but as incompatibility, a feature of a more advanced system trying to run on older hardware.
Exactly. The disorder label is seen as a misunderstanding of their true nature. They are positioned as cosmic change agents. Their inherent difference is the tool for change.
So what are the specific characteristics mentioned in these spiritual sources? How do they align with the ADHD profile we discussed earlier, but seen through this cosmic lens?
The alignment is pretty striking, actually. These sources list traits for the volunteers like a deep, often painful difficulty with rigid, linear learning and rote memorization, an almost uncanny ability for pattern recognition, seeing connections instantly, often bypassing logical steps. A strong, visceral rejection of arbitrary authority, pointless rules, and inefficient bureaucracies. And innate, natural systems thinking they just get how complex things connect and interact. High sensitivity to environments, to energy, to emotions, sometimes feeling easily overwhelmed. And a real talent for creative problem solving that often seems to come out of left field, ignoring the proper way to do things. You can see how each of these mirrors aspects of the cognitive architecture, but reinterpreted spiritually.
It reframes the struggle entirely. It's not, I can't cope. It's, this system isn't compatible with my operating mode. Many of these sources also talk about an awakening process that these individuals often go through. What does that typically involve?
It's often described as a period of escalating spiritual awakenings, sometimes triggered by hitting rock bottom, maybe burnout from trying to fit into the standard world, or a major life crisis. It's framed as a journey of remembering their deeper purpose, why they volunteered to be here. A huge part of it involves intense inner work, learning self-acceptance, self-love, forgiveness for past struggles which, from this view, were often coping mechanisms for living in an incompatible system. The goal is achieving a state of alignment, becoming a clearer vessel for higher consciousness, energy, and love, enabling them to fulfill their change agent role.
And this awakening journey often involves seeking out specific knowledge or tools, right? A search for cosmic alignment through certain texts or practices.
Yes, there's a definite emphasis on finding resonance and connecting patterns across different wisdom traditions. Certain sources are frequently mentioned as holding key pieces of this ancient wisdom or cosmic history. Three that come up repeatedly are the Seth material, channeled by Jane Roberts, which delves deep into the nature of reality, consciousness, and the self beyond the physical. The Law of One, also known as the Ra material, which presents a complex cosmology about the evolution of consciousness throughout the universe and different dimensions or densities. And the work of Dolores Cannon, known for her method of deep past life regression hypnosis, which she claimed accessed subconscious knowledge about soul history and purpose. Finding consistent themes across these very different sources is often seen by followers as a kind of validation or proof of the underlying truth.
Interesting. And beyond studying these texts, are there practical techniques mentioned, energy work or specific practices?
Definitely. There's mention of using tools like binaural beats, audio frequencies, designed to influence brainwave states. They specifically reference something called the HemiLab Ultra Project in this context, aiming for states conducive to expanded awareness. And perhaps most central are advanced meditative or hypnotic techniques like quantum healing hypnosis technique, QHHT, developed by Dolores Cannon, or similar methods like beyond quantum healing, PQH. The goal of these deep regression sessions is usually to connect directly with the individual's own higher self or access subconscious memories, potentially including pre-life planning or understanding the volunteer contract.
This shared sense of purpose, this idea of pre-life mission, it naturally leads to a strong call to action, doesn't it? The sources talk about needing to get the band back together.
Exactly. There's this feeling among those who resonate with this blueprint of recognizing each other, of finding their soul family or fellow convoluted neurodivergent volunteers, as one source playfully puts it. The collective mission is often described in pretty grand terms, to help shift the overall consciousness on Earth towards more positive, harmonious states, to nudge evolution along. And then apparently the reward is throwing the most massive celestial party the cosmos has ever witnessed. There's a sense of both serious purpose and cosmic joy.
A celestial party, okay. But how do they actually plan to achieve this shift in consciousness? What's the strategy? They can't exactly force everyone to believe this stuff.
No, and the sources emphasize that trying to force it, trying to aggressively convince others or radically overhaul systems overnight, usually backfires. It leads to resistance and burnout for the volunteers themselves. So the strategy is much more subtle. It's about planting seeds of curiosity.
Seeds of curiosity? How does that work?
The idea relies on the nature of the neurodivergent mind itself, that powerful, interest-driven, variable gain system. If you introduce just a spark, a fascinating idea, a question that resonates, that mind is likely to grab onto it and explore it with intense hyperfocus, naturally. The volunteers don't need to drag people along. They just need to offer the intriguing starting points. The mind's own drive for exploration and pattern seeking will do the rest of the work, leading to self-discovery and potentially a gradual shift in perspective on their own terms.
Okay, we've journeyed through two very different landscapes. The detailed scientific cognitive architecture mapping a brain optimized for exploration, and the expansive cosmic blueprint describing galactic volunteers here to initiate change. Now, how do we bring these together? Yeah. The sources seem to suggest a grand unification theorem of sorts, right?
They do. The synthesis argues that these aren't contradictory views, but perhaps two different languages describing the same underlying reality. The core conclusion is that this neurospicy cognition, as some playfully call it, isn't broken or delayed. It's actually advanced. It represents a type of processing, maybe even a type of consciousness that's inherently capable of handling more complexity, more connections, more data than the systems built during the industrial age were designed for. It predates and potentially supersedes those limitations.
So the high bandwidth, the pattern recognition, that's useful whether you're designing a Mars colony in a project-based school or recognizing synchronicity described in ancient texts.
Precisely. The hardware capabilities serve both the practical innovation and the metaphysical exploration. And this synthesis lets us outline the principles for the kind of society that would actually support this hardware, the blueprint for the symbiotic cognitive ecosystem.
Okay, what are the key principles of this new societal OS?
First, it demands fluid architectures over rigid institutions. Our environments, schools, offices, even community spaces need to become modular, like creating cognitive niches you can quickly reconfigure. Need deep focus. There's a space for that. Need high energy collaboration. A space for that. Need quiet restoration. Got it. The environment adapts to the mind's needs in real time, not the other way around.
Makes sense. What's the second principle? It sounds like hierarchy would need to change too.
Big time. The second principle is contextual leadership over static hierarchy. This recognizes that the variable gain system means expertise isn't fixed. Someone might enter hyper-focus on a specific problem and become the de facto expert for that situation, regardless of their job title. So leadership roles and authority become fluid. They shift based on the specific challenge at hand. You leverage intense focus in a crisis or divergent thinking during innovation, drawing on whoever has the relevant gain at that moment. Authority becomes a temporary tool, not a permanent status.
And how we measure success or value would have to change dramatically. No more punching clocks or just counting widgets.
Exactly. The third principle is outcome portfolios over standardized metrics. Instead of just measuring hours worked or tasks completed linearly, you look at a richer portfolio of outcomes. Things like how many complex problems were solved, how many novel connections or insights were generated, how many valuable collaborations were forged. This creates a system where diverse cognitive styles are actually valued for their unique outputs rather than being penalized for not fitting the old narrow measures of productivity.
It sounds like a much more dynamic and, frankly, interesting way to organize things. The sources even get a bit playful describing the software that might run on this new societal hardware, right? The conceptual NeuroSpiciOS V2.0.
Yes. It's a great way to illustrate how the external coprocessor idea could manifest in practical, user-friendly ways, even if it's metaphorical for now. Think about features designed specifically for this cognitive style, like AutoSwitch. This feature would conceptually allow the user to shift attention between tasks or trains of thought seamlessly without the usual guilt or self-criticism. It normalizes that fluid multi-track processing as the default mode.
Okay, I could use that. What else? How does it handle all those brilliant ideas that pop up at inconvenient times?
For that, you have the tangent vault. Imagine whenever you have a great off-topic idea during a meeting or while trying to focus, you just mentally send it to the vault. It gets automatically archived, maybe tagged, probably genius review later.
Yeah.
This acknowledges the divergent thought, captures its value, but allows you to return to the primary task without feeling like you've lost something important or derailed the conversation. It respects the popcorn brain phenomenon.
That's brilliant. And what about managing motivation, that core variable gain engine?
That's where the dopamine dashboard comes in. It's conceptualized as a way to visualize your internal motivation landscape. Maybe shows you green zones where your interest and energy are high, perfect for tackling complex tasks, and red zones indicating low interest or dwindling dopamine, signaling it's time to switch tasks, take a break, or deploy a specific scaffolding strategy, like body doubling or breaking the task down. It makes managing your energy more conscious and strategic. And this OS wouldn't track productivity in the old sense. The new key metrics would be things like wonder throughput or innovation density, measuring the generation of valuable sparks, not just output volume.
Wonder throughput. I love it. It really captures the shift in value. So this all culminates in one final powerful message, doesn't it? The final reframe. From deficit to divine design, we need to actively replace the old negative labels.
Absolutely. This is the core takeaway of the neurodivergent renaissance, synthesized from both the scientific and cosmic perspectives. We need to consciously translate. Where the industrial label diagnosed sensory overload, the cosmic truth, or the cognitive architecture truth, is reality streaming in HD plus sensory solving. It's a feature, not a bug hire data intake.
Okay. And where the old system saw poor executive function.
The reframe is creative priority over compliance. The system is intelligently allocating resources towards novelty and meaning, not just arbitrary demands.
And the classic label.
The radical reframe,
yeah.
Simultaneously present in 12 realities. This speaks to that parallel processing, the multidimensional mapping, the mind constantly scanning possibilities. It's the change agent operating at the edge, seeing more than the linear system acknowledges.
It completely shifts the narrative. The problem wasn't the person, it was the lens we were using to look at them.
Exactly. The ultimate conclusion drawn from all this material is that the neurodivergent renaissance isn't just about accommodations. It's about recognizing this as a necessary step in the conscious evolution of human collective cognition. It's the moment we decide, collectively, to stop forcing incredibly diverse, powerful cognitive hardware to run outdated, narrow, industrial-era cultural software. It's time for a system upgrade for humanity. Hashtag outro.
Wow. Okay, so just to recap this incredible journey, we've explored two powerful parallel narratives today. On one side, we dug into the cognitive science. The detailed architecture of the ADHD mind is being built for high bandwidth exploration and parallel processing, a mind that requires society, our systems, to act as that external co-processor to truly thrive.
Mm-hmm. And on the other side, we explored the metaphysical perspective. The view of these same minds as cosmic change agents, as volunteers who chose to be here, operating differently precisely because their purpose is to nudge our collective consciousness forward, often by planting those crucial seeds of curiosity.
And the synthesis, the final invocation, feels really profound. Mm-hmm. It suggests that by intentionally designing our schools, our workplaces, our culture to work for the ADHD mind, embracing that need for fluidity, novelty, passion, deep dives, we don't just help one group. We actually end up creating a more dynamic, more adaptable, more innovative collective intelligence that benefits absolutely everyone.
It's an upgrade for the whole system. And that leads us right into the final, really provocative thought that emerged from the sources. Something for all of you to chew on. What is? What if the universe itself is, in some way, ADHD coded? Think about it. Modern cosmology tells us it's expanding faster than we expected, filled with seemingly chaotic patterns, dark energy, things emerging from apparent randomness. And yet, out of that vast, dynamic, sometimes messy process, it consistently creates incredible structure, complexity, beauty, stars, galaxies, life itself. Maybe the bug, the disorder, was never the individual human mind. Maybe it was in the systems we built that forgot a fundamental truth. Imagination requires mess.
Imagination requires mess. A perfect thought to end on. That's all for this deep dive.